make a couple extra comments. We're basically all done with writing down the model, the standard model. We wrote down all of the four fermion interactions once you integrate out the W boson, which will allow for fermions of different type to change from one to the other. And all of those interactions are governed by Fermi's constant. So what is Fermi's constant? So we wrote GF over square root 2. And this was the gauge coupling, little g squared over 8 mw squared. This is what we get once we know we're integrating out some actual degree of freedom. And well, we can use the fact that mw is equal to g times v over 2. So if I just plug this in, the g's will cancel off. And I'll just have 1 over 2 times v squared. So if you want to know numerically what is the VEV, it is just related to Fermi's constant, square root of 2 times g Fermi to the minus 1 half power. So we can compute what it is. Well, how do we measure the Fermi constant? Well, you can measure it through any of the processes that I wrote down. But the most accurate way to measure it is through muon decay. And so it has been found to be 1.166 times 10 to the minus 5 inverse GeV squared. And so once you plug this in to V, you get that this is around 246 GeV. So okay, so the VEV is a parameter that we know very well. And I just want to mention one other thing, which is that there's actually two different conventions for writing down the VEV. And so I just want you to be aware of that so you won't get confused. And it's kind of split 50-50 which one people like to use. In the alternative convention, is to write the Higgs field as 0 v plus little h over square root 2. So, okay, it's kind of trivial, but the difference is there's no 1 over square root 2 here. And so in this convention, v is around 174 GeV. So if you see an expression in terms of v, you have to be a little bit careful which convention people are talking about. Okay. Now I just want to mention something related to the standard model, which is goes under the name of accidental symmetries. And the question can be explained as follows. We know that there are conservation laws in the standard model. For example, electric charge is conserved. That follows just based on the gauge interaction of electromagnetism. But there can be charges that correspond to conserved quantities that don't arise through a gauge symmetry. For example, why is the proton stable? You know, why can't the proton decay into a positron and a photon, for example? There's nothing wrong with conservation of charge, but the reason that doesn't happen is due to an accidental symmetry. So an accidental symmetry is a global symmetry. That arises just because it's impossible to write down anything that would violate the symmetry. And I should say any renormalizable interaction. In the standard model, there are four accidental symmetries. There is a baryon number. And lepton flavor symmetries. We should go under the name LE, L mu, and L tau. So these are all U1 symmetries. I should write that in. You can have other symmetries as well, but in the standard model, these are all U1. So what do these mean? So let's consider first baryon number symmetry. So if we consider all of the quarks in the standard model Lagrangian, all of the terms involving the quark fields have the following structure. We have some quark fields, Q bar, and then there's some Dirac parts, which I'll just denote by gamma. And actually, gamma might also involve color indices as well. So there could be a Gell-Mann matrix floating around in this gamma. And then there'll be another quark fields, Q prime like this. And they don't have to be the same field, of course. There may be derivatives, who knows? But any term you can write down involving quarks will always involve a Q bar and a Q, contracted together in some way. So now we can do a U1 rotation on the quark field, and we have to rotate them all in the same way, with the same phase, just because we don't know which two types of quarks may enter. There could be any combination. So we can do a rotation where every quark field goes to e to the I theta times the quark fields. And so Q bar will go to e to the minus I theta Q bar. So as long as we rotate all of the quark fields with the same phase, every term of the structure will be invariant. So that's the global U1 symmetry. So the Lagrangian for the standard model is invariant. And so this is written as a U1 baryon number symmetry. And it's a little bit arbitrary. You assign the U1 charges of all of the quark fields to be 1/3. The baryon number for a quark field will be 1/3. Baryon number for an antiquark will be -1/3. And the baryon number will be 0 for leptons and all of the gauge bosons and the Higgs bosons. OK. So, of course, the reason it was chosen to be 1/3 is such that for the proton, if I combine together 3 quarks, the total baryon number will be 1. Okay. So this requires the lightest baryon in the theory, the proton, to be stable. And so that's the reason why the proton does not decay in the standard model. Now, there's also 3 other symmetries as well, corresponding to the lepton flavor symmetries. So first, let's just talk about LE. So this is another U1 global symmetry, U1 LE. And under this transformation, the electron field is rotated by a phase. The electron neutrino field is rotated by a phase, the same phase. and all other fields are invariant. This type of transformation leaves the standard model invariant. The reason it's a bit different from the quarks is because in the lepton sector, the charge-current interaction only couples together electron and electron neutrino. There's no mixing between the different flavors. Okay. So you assign the electron and the electron neutrino field to have this lepton number one. And it would be minus one for the corresponding antiparticles. And it would be equal to zero for everything else. So the other two lepton flavor symmetries are very similar. So you have an L mu symmetry, and you have an L tau symmetry. So this is a U1 L mu and a U1 L tau. And this transforms the muon fields. E to the I theta and nu mu goes to E to the I theta nu mu. And this one transforms the tau fields. And the other fields are invariant. So for the muon and the muon neutrino, they would have L mu is equal to plus 1. And then the tau and the tau neutrino would have L tau equal to plus 1. And otherwise, it works the same way as the lepton flavor symmetry. So there's four conserved quantum numbers from these four different symmetries. So baryon number is conserved. Lepton number of electron flavor is conserved. Muon flavor and tau flavor are all independently conserved. So, for example, the proton can't decay. It's the lightest baryon. It would violate baryon number symmetry. Also, the muon. When the muon decayed, it had to decay into a muon antineutrino, an electron, and an electron antineutrino. So those processes conserve L mu, and it also conserves Le. There's no process like mu to electron plus a photon, for example. That process would violate L mu and Le, okay? Even though it's allowed by conservation of electric charge. There's another quantum number, which it's useful to define. L, the total lepton number, that's just Le plus L mu plus L tau. And since each of these three things is conserved, of course, the total lepton number is also conserved. So we've totally ignore neutrino masses in what we've done so far. And neutrino masses can potentially violate the lepton symmetries. So we'll see this at the very end of lectures. So first of all, if we put in neutrino masses, they are guaranteed to violate the flavor symmetries. And the reason is that we know that there's a mixing between the mass eigenstates of the neutrinos and the gauge eigenstates of the neutrinos, which is what we've written down so far. So the flavor symmetries are known to be violated. But the neutrino masses are a little bit peculiar because they can also lead to a violation of lepton number symmetry as well. We don't know if they do. So they certainly violate these symmetries, but they may also violate L as well. Yes?
Just going back to what you said, B equals 1 for proton, so proton is stable. Is that what you mean? Isn't
yes.
it the same for the neutron, but neutron is stable?
So it's only true for the lightest state. The neutron is heavier than the proton, so it can decay to a proton. And so baryon number is conserved in that case because you have plus 1 and plus 1.
But would you call neutron stable then?
No, it's not stable, of course, it decays. Doesn't mean that every particle with charge is stable. Like the muon, for example, has electric charge, but it's not stable. It can decay in a way that conserves electric charge. Of course, if it was the lightest state, it has to be stable because there's no lighter state with electric charge to decay into. So that's the case for the electron. So for neutrinos, we don't really know exactly how the symmetries work. And this is related to the question of, could the neutrino be its own antiparticle? So if it is its own antiparticle, that would violate lepton number symmetry, since the neutrino and antineutrino would have lepton number plus 1 and minus 1. And if it's the same, then it makes no sense to define lepton number. On the other hand, neutrinos and antineutrinos may be distinct, in which case L may be conserved, but still these three symmetries are broken. Okay. So that's the standard model. And I just want to summarize by explaining or writing down what are all of the parameters of the standard model. So first we have three gauge couplings. G, G prime, and GS for SU2 left, U1 hypercharge, and the strong interaction. We have two Higgs parameters. We can write those parameters as the mass of the Higgs, mh squared, which is twice mu squared. So I can think of mu squared as the parameter or the Higgs mass as the parameter. It's equivalent. And also, there's the quartic coupling, lambda. And if I know the Higgs mass and I know the VEV, then I fixed these two parameters. So for example, B, I think, was equal to square root of mu squared over lambda. So once I know V and I know the Higgs mass, then I can fix lambda. Then there's also nine fermion masses. There's the mass of the up quark, the mass of the charm quark, the mass of the top quark, mass of the down, strange, bottom, electron, muon, and tau. There's also also parameters of the CKM matrix. Vij. In tutorial, I think today, you'll have to figure out how many independent parameters there are in this unitary matrix. You might think there's a lot, but actually there's four. So you'll see that. So there's four CKM matrix parameters. In other words, you can express this 3x3 unitary matrix just in terms of four parameters. These parameters can be measured. Recall that they enter into the weak charge-current interaction in the transitions between different types of quark flavors. And so by measuring processes that convert one quark flavor to another, all of these different parameters have been measured. There's also one other parameter, which I haven't discussed. which is known as theta QCD. So this is actually an additional term that I could write down in Lagrangian that involves the gluon fields. And we're not going to describe what this term is. Because as far as we can tell, this term in the Lagrangian does not appear to be there. It doesn't appear to be realized in nature. This parameter has been searched for. People have tried to measure this parameter. But as far as we can tell, it's consistent with zero. So it just seems to be an experimental fact that theta QCD is around zero. How close is it to zero? Well, the present limits are around, it has to be less than around 10 to the minus 10 or so. So it's a puzzle why that's the case. We don't really understand why. So these are all of the parameters in the standard model. And in principle, you could compute everything, every experimental observable that you would want in terms of all of these parameters. In practice, it's much more complicated than that. Because first of all, because the dynamics of QCD are strongly coupled, you can't, or I should say, it's very difficult to compute anything from first principles when it comes to low-energy QCD. So that's one practical stumbling block. The other thing is that we haven't included neutrino masses. And so there will be more parameters due to the neutrino masses. And there also are more parameters due to the mixing in the neutrino sector. So we haven't included those parameters as well. So far, this is what we have. So how many do we have? Let's see. That's 14 plus 4 would be 18. OK, so there's 18 parameters that we have for the standard model. Why are there 18? Where do they come from? The standard model doesn't tell you. So the next topic, so we're going to start a new topic now. That topic is deep inelastic scattering. Also known as DIS. And the question that we have is as follows. So I wrote down the standard model Lagrangian in terms of quarks, but quarks, of course, are bound together inside of hadrons. How do we know that quarks exist? How do we know that they are spin 1/2 and that they have the quantum numbers that they do? So that question has been resolved due to deep inelastic scattering and experiments that have been performed, I guess, back in the 70s to establish that quarks exist. And so we're going to go through what the argument is. So the first thing to notice is that you can't unbind a free quark from a hadron. You might try to collide a very energetic particle into the hadron, like a proton, to separate out a free quark. It doesn't help you separate out a free quark. And the reason why is due to confinement. So in a nutshell, trying to free a quark from a hadron just produces more hadrons. So for example, let's say you have an electron beam, and you have a proton target. So the proton target will be a UUD. The electron beam could interact with the quarks, which carry electric charge inside the proton. So there can be a scattering. And they will scatter through a virtual photon. And so if it hits one of these quarks, this quark will get a high energy kick, and you would think it would leave the proton, okay? So the U quark, let's say, goes over here, and the rest of the proton, okay, goes in this direction, like this. But it takes, of course, a lot of energy to separate the quark from the rest of the proton, because the potential, due to the strong interaction, phenomenologically has this expression where it grows linearly as you increase the distance. So once this quark goes far enough away, the energy cost is too great. It actually becomes energetically favorable just to create a new quark-antiquark pair to make everything neutral again. So you might create, for example, an anti-down quark and a down quark like this. But maybe this U quark still has a lot of energy, and these two things are separated. And so you can still create another quark-antiquark pair. Let's say a U and a U bar, and a U and a D bar, like this. So this would be like a neutron. This would be mesons. And so you can imagine through this process, once you try to free, the harder you try to free a quark, the more hadrons you're going to end up producing. And you won't have any free quarks left at the end of the day. So this process is known as fragmentation. Or hadronization. The reason this happens is due to due to the beta function of QCD being negative. So if I sketch alpha s, which is gs squared over 4 pi, as a function of energy, then the beta function will look like this. So of course, it's asymptotically free at high energies. But at low energies, the coupling becomes arbitrarily large, and it diverges around some value, which is called lambda QCD. So there's a Landau pole at lambda QCD, which is around 200 MeV. So I can think of confinement as a process that occurs at low energies around lambda QCD, also at large distance scales. I could write distance as going in this direction. So hadronization. Is a non-perturbative effect. When alpha s over 4 pi approaches 1, at energy scales around lambda QCD. So not only can I think of it as an energy, low energy, but also if I think of it as a distance, the characteristic distance for hadronization is as follows. It's just 1 over lambda QCD. And in physical distance units, this is around a femtometer. 10 to the minus 16 meters, or 10 to the minus 15 meters. And so it's no accident that this is actually the radius of the proton, approximately. So you can kind of think of quarks as being confined within a certain radius, the radius of the proton. And if I try to, okay, separate them out, then I run into problems. All right. Now, the flip side to confinement is asymptotic freedom. So at small distances, much, much less than what's set by lambda QCD, quarks behave like free particles. And in other words, perturbation theory is valid. Just because the coupling over 4 pi is much, much smaller than 1. So these two facts imply an important result, which is known as factorization. And I can, let me explain it in words first. And what it means is that what happens at short distances isn't affected by what happens at large distances. By large and small, I mean in comparison to this lambda QCD scale. So in comparison to the scale of a femtometer. Because of factorization, this is the reason why it's possible to make precise calculations for high energy processes which involve quarks. For example, at the LHC, they're colliding together protons and on protons. You might say, well, protons are bound states of some non-perturbative object. How can we ever hope to compute anything, like how many Higgs bosons are produced from that type of initial state? The reason we can is because of factorization. So this is what makes calculations possible. For initial states with hadrons. So we're not going to consider just yet proton-proton collisions. We're going to get there, and we're going to think about what this will imply for Higgs boson production eventually. But now we're going to consider kind of a simpler type of scattering process. And so the process that we'll look at is electron-proton scattering. And so here, let me write down a Feynman diagram. We have an electron, and it scatters to an electron. There's an interaction through the photon. I have a proton. And when the electron hits the proton, it will fragment into a bunch of different hadronic states. So this is 1, 2, 3, up to n. And this will be h is my hadronic final state. So what we're going to do to start with is we're not going to assume anything about factorization or anything like that. We're going to try to compute this process as best we can, assuming that we know nothing about what this interaction, what happens in this interaction. Or we're not going to assume anything about the fact that protons are made out of quarks, for example. So we're going to be completely general in the way we proceed. Then we're going to redo the calculation given factorization and the fact that we have quarks making up hadrons. And we'll see what we get. So here is the process. So h is my hadronic final state. There's two situations which we could consider. There's elastic scattering. Elastic just means that the initial and final states are the same. So if h was only just equal to a proton, this would be elastic scattering. So this is the case where the proton, even though it's being struck by a virtual photon, is not being broken up into multiple hadrons. Then there's also inelastic scattering. Where h is equal to multiple hadrons. And so you would say that the proton is broken up into all of these different hadrons. Still conserving baryon number and other conserved charges. So now I want to write down some of the momenta involved. So this will be momentum L and L prime. This will be momentum capital P. And so L mu is the incoming electron. L prime mu is the outgoing electron. P mu is the initial incoming proton momentum. And then P prime mu will be the sum of all of the outgoing hadron momenta. So this would be a sum from 1 to n of all of the hadronic final state momenta, p prime I mu. So this is the total final state hadrons. Oh, I forgot one more momentum. This is also q going down. All right, so we're going to consider this process at high energies. So it's sufficient to set the electron mass to 0. And we also have the photon momentum. Q, which is L minus L prime. So before we proceed further, it's helpful to define a whole bunch of different kinematic variables. So first of all, I want to define a quantity capital Q squared. This is just equal to minus little q squared. And this is known as the momentum transfer. Squared. The reason that we have this minus sign in front is just so that big Q squared is always a positive number. So this is minus L prime squared. And so this is just 2 L dot L prime. L squared and L prime squared are both 0 because the electron mass is 0. And so this is 2 EL EL prime 1 minus cosine theta. So this quantity is always greater than 0. Here, theta is a scattering angle. Of the outgoing electron. The next variable is called nu. This is defined as p dot q over mp. What does this correspond to? Well, it's useful to think of this variable in the rest frame of the initial proton. So that would be like the lab frame. If your proton was a target at rest in the lab frame, let's consider what nu is in that frame. In the rest frame of the proton, p is just equal to mp 0, 0, 0. And so in this case, nu is just equal to, so the mps will cancel off. And here I'll just have the energy. I'll just have q, the 0 component of q, which is just the difference of energies, el minus el prime. So nu in the lab frame is just the energy transfer. Variable 3 is known as y, and this is p dot q over p dot l. It's also useful to compute this one in this lab frame in which the proton is at rest. So this is, or let me do it like this. So in the proton rest frame, p dot l is just equal to mp dot the energy of the incoming lepton. So if I plug this in and also what I computed here, this is just el minus el prime over el. And so this is 1 minus el over, or el prime over el. This is the fractional energy transfer in the lab frame. And the last variable is known as x. So it's minus q squared over 2p dot q. And so I can write this as q squared over 2p dot q. And I can also use my definition of nu to write this as q squared over 2mp times nu. It's a bit mysterious so far, but this variable x will play an important role. It's also named after the person that wrote it down, Bjorkheim. So it's known as sort of Bjorkheim x. The reason of writing down all of these different variables is just because we want to write down, it's useful just to write down Lorentz invariant variables. Therefore, they're the same in any reference frame we want. So let's consider what the meaning of x is. To see what x means, let's first consider elastic scattering. So this is an electron and a proton going to an electron and a proton. So there's only one particle in the final states. So there's only one hadronic final particle in the final state. Momentum conservation implies the following. We have P plus L is equal to P prime plus L prime. So we can evaluate the following quantity, MP prime squared. This is just equal to the proton mass, since I only have one final state particle. And then using the conservation law, I have P plus L minus L prime squared. And so this is MP squared plus 2 P dotted into L minus L prime, which is just Q. And then I have Q squared for the term that's L minus L prime squared. So the MPs will cancel off from both sides. And I will just have the following. 2 P dot Q is equal to minus little q squared, or big Q squared with a plus sign in front. So I can write this as Q squared over 2 P dot Q is equal to 1. And the quantity on the left-hand side is just x. So for elastic scattering, x is equal to 1. Now we'll do inelastic scattering. So we have P prime. Our momentum P prime is the total momentum of all of the different hadronic states. And so this would be equal to P prime 1 plus P prime 2 plus dot, dot, dot. So let's try going through the same argument that we did here for a momentum like this for inelastic scattering. So I'll compute the following, P prime squared. And so this is P prime 1 plus P prime 2, dot, 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 all squared. And okay, there's going to be a lot of terms here. There's going to be terms that are just going to be like P1 prime squared. That will be the mass of state 1 squared. And then I'll have the mass of state 2 squared plus dot, dot, dot. Those will be all of the squared terms, all of the momentum squared terms. But then there's also going to be cross terms as well. I'll just write this as plus cross terms. This quantity here, you can see it's always going to be greater than the proton mass squared. Okay. So if I write the following quantity, P prime squared minus MP squared, this is equal to 2 times P dotted into Q plus little q squared, or I can write this as 2 times P dotted into Q for 1 minus x. This number is always greater than 0, because what's on the left-hand side is always greater than 0. here in the second step to get from here to here, I just use the definition of x. Okay, so first of all, p dot q is always, let's note that p dot q is always greater than 0. We know that this must be true since nu must always be greater than 0. It's just the energy transfer. The energy transfer has to be positive. Therefore, nu must be greater than 0, and therefore, p dot q must be greater than 0. So this implies that x must always be less than 1. Also, we know the following, that q squared must also be greater than 0. We already proved this. Because nu must be positive, q squared must be positive, therefore x must also be positive. So this implies that x must be greater than 0. So we have an allowed range for x for inelastic scattering. We would have x has to be between 0 and 1. So in a sense, x measures whether or not we have inelastic versus elastic scattering. If x is equal to 1, then it's elastic. And if it's less than 1, greater than 0, we have inelastic scattering. So that's sort of the meaning of x. OK. So let's recall the following fact. So if we have 2-to-2 scattering, the differential cross section d sigma by d cos theta just has one independent kinematic variable. In addition to the center of mass energy. Which I'll call S. So this you know, if you have a differential cross-section, you can describe it by the total center of mass energy S. But you need one other variable, which could be cosine theta, or it could be Mandelstam variable T, or it could be the Mandelstam variable U. Doesn't matter which one you choose, but only one of them is independent. So it could be cosine theta, T, or U. I guess those would be the common obvious choices. So here, for elastic scattering, which is x is equal to 1, the differential cross-section will also have one independent variable. And so I could choose q squared, I could choose nu, I could choose y, or I could choose cosine theta, for example. I can't choose x. X is equal to 1. But any of the other three variables could function perfectly well as my independent variable for elastic scattering. And this is in addition to the center of mass energy. Which in this case is L plus P quantity squared. On the other hand, for inelastic scattering, there must be extra kinematic variables. So we have x between 0 and 1, and we must have two independent kinematic variables. So you can either choose, x and one of the following, q squared, nu, or y. But we need more information to specify the kinematics. And this is also in addition to S. So this is an important sort of theme that's going to come up later on. If you have elastic scattering, there's only one independent kinematic variable, but we're considering inelastic scattering. And so we need more two independent kinematic variables. All right, so now what we're going to do is compute, as best we can, the inelastic scattering cross-section. So here's the process. We're going to compute what's called inclusive scattering. Which I'll write as the cross-section for an electron scattering off a proton to make an electron. And then X will stand for all possible final hadronic states. And so this I can write as a sum over all of the hadronic final states H. And then the individual cross-sections for each final state. So we're summing over all of the different final states we can have. We're also going to be working in the deep inelastic regime, which just means that the square root of S will be much, much greater than the mass of the proton, and also the energy transfer will be much, much greater than the mass of the proton. So those are going to be the assumptions. And so let me try to write down this cross-section. And you see, I'm not going to really know how to compute anything about this cross-section. And so what we're going to do is just parameterize the things that we don't know using some simple arguments. But at the end of the day, our result is just going to be expressed in terms of some unknowns. That's just what we have to do. So here is the cross-section. So we have here. And so I want to sum over all possible hadronic final states. And then I should write down the individual cross-sections for a given hadronic final state. And so I have a prefactor, which is 1 over 2e for the incoming electron, 1 over 2ep, the energy of the incoming proton, I divide by the magnitude of the relative velocity. And then I have to integrate over the final state momenta. I have to integrate over the final state hadronic momenta. And who knows how many there are. I have momentum conserving delta function. Then I have my matrix element squared. So I have 1/4 for the average over initial spins. Here it's just the proton spin and the electron spin in the initial state. Sum over spins times the square of the matrix element for a given hadronic final state. Okay, so we'll stop here for today. When we pick up tomorrow, we're going to compute this cross-section as best we can. Again, we don't know very much about it. We're just going to parameterize our ignorance. But then you'll see where we're going.